Hello, everyone. Hi, Lori. and hello to everyone else. Very happy Sunday. We are here now for the 7 steps to awakening. And then in an hour, it is time for our monthly membership meeting. And the first part of the membership meeting, I am going to dedicate to Cheryl Valentine, who transitioned, let go of the body, however you like to say that, moved on last night, or early this morning, really. And, you know, we're going to just celebrate her heritage, celebrate what we have received from her and what she has left with us, what she represents. So hopefully y'all will be available in about an hour to hang out with me and remember Cheryl. And then after that, we will move on to a couple other things in the member meeting, but probably the first half hour or so will be dedicated to our beloved Cheryl Valentine. Right now, again, we're going to be doing the 7 steps to awakening, and we're going to be starting with 583. So I am posting a link in the room to 583. Oops, that's not it. Wonder where that came from. That's something I copied like a week ago, and it didn't paste then, and now it just now pasted. Isn't that interesting? Let's see what happens. Oh my gosh, I'm having some kind of a weird situation with my clipboard. What it's doing, last Wednesday I tried to post the link to Ramana and the Guru, the audio, the true Guru I called it, and it wouldn't paste, so I had to type it in. And now I'm trying to copy and paste this link, and whenever I copy it, and then paste it, I'm getting this thing I copied last week that didn't show up, and there's no way I can make it work. Isn't that the funniest thing? So I can't give you the link. I don't know what in the world would cause something that I copied a week ago. I've copied many things since then to come up and not what I'm trying to copy now. But let me just tell you how you can find the link, and then maybe Lynn will be able to copy it and paste it. The link is, if you go to RDA7, and that is the digit 7, it is not spelled out, RDA7stepsjournal.wordpress.com. Again, the address is RDA7stepsjournal.wordpress.com. And then when you get there, you can click on step 3 on the menu bar. And you'll want to choose the numbering sequence that's going to allow you to find your way to 583. And 583 is where we are beginning. Again, I'm not quite sure what in the world would be going on with my clipboard that would make it behave in the way it is. That's a bizarre, bizarre thing that something I copied half a week ago is now pasting when it wouldn't paste half a week ago. And I've copied and pasted other things since then. Very bizarre. It looks like Lynn maybe already has it for you. We'll see if that link works. I can't send it to you in IM because I can't paste it at all. Yeah, I can't do that. I'm unable to copy it and paste it completely because of some bizarre technical thing that I could never even begin to understand. Why don't we start with a moment of silence? Amen. I don't think the above link will work now. You can try clicking on it, but I think that you have to go to rda7stepsjournal.wordpress.com. You have to physically go there and then click on step 3 at the website and then find 583. And then you'll have the link. But we can do without the links. People can just listen. If that's the way it's going to be tonight, that's the way it's going to be. Yeah, you could go to that link, Lynn. That would work. And then once people get there, click on step 3 and then find 583. As always, I'm going to read first from the book, The 7 Steps to Awakening. And right now the quotes are all coming from Nisargadatta Maharaj. And this is quote 583. Any name or shape you give yourself obscures your real nature. Very, very simple quote. Any name or shape you give yourself obscures your real nature. And actually, that fits very, very well with a little excerpt I'm going to be playing later. I told you that at the top of the hour, when I begin the member meeting, I'm going to begin by celebrating Cheryl Valentine. And one of the things I've done is I've picked out an excerpt from one of her talks that I'm going to play. And actually, this quote fits very, very well with that excerpt I'm going to play from Cheryl. Any name or shape you give yourself obscures your real nature. But I will, I won't give away Cheryl's talk, but maybe after we listen to Cheryl's talk, I'll come back and read this again and we'll see how it all fit together. For right now, I'm just going to go directly to my journal and I'm going to read what I wrote when I contemplated this back in 2012. If I say I am this body, I do not know who I am. It is like focusing on the drawing that has been drawn upon me and saying, I am that, when I am the paper. If I say I am this changing, maturing person, I do not know who I am. It is like focusing on the drawing that has been drawn and saying, I am that, when I am the paper. If I identify with an opinion or position and say I am that, I do not know who I am. That is also like focusing on the drawing that has been drawn upon me, believing I am the pencil or chalk marks when I am the paper. If I identify with a function or role and say I am that, I am likewise like the paper, identifying with the drawing that has been drawn upon it. There is nothing I can identify with and know myself. Anything I can identify with is like the drawing drawn upon the paper. I am like the paper. And then after that, in the journal, there's something in italics. And italics is typically, you could call it like an exercise that came in for me to practice after contemplating the quote. And the exercise is this. Notice subtle thoughts of identification. Ask, has this been constant? Can this be what I am? Or is this just the drawing drawn upon what I am? Return to what I am, free of any drawing. That's a wonderful practice. And in fact, it's a practice that later in 2013, when True Discernment, the first part of the MPP program, was developed, it's a practice that actually ended up in True Discernment. So some of you who are in True Discernment, who have taken True Discernment, may recognize this. It's a matter of noticing that, if I look back at when I was 5 years old, or if I look back at when I was 15 years old, or even when I was 30 years old, and I notice how I identified myself then, what I thought about myself then, what my role was, who I was, just in every way. And I compare that to how I would identify myself now or describe myself now, I'm going to find that there are maybe a few consistencies. Like, I think I've always liked sunshine. I think I've always liked grass. I think I've always liked butterflies. You know, there's a few consistencies. But there are a whole lot of things that have changed over the lifetime, a whole lot of ideas about who I am that have changed. You know, when I was 5, I thought of myself as a child. That was my identification. I did not think of myself as an adult. I don't even think I thought of myself as a person. I thought of myself as a child, right? I was a child and I was in an adult world. And I don't think of myself as a child now. So these identifications that we have are not constant. They change. And yet, somehow that isness that thought of itself as a child, and that isness that later thought of itself as a teenager, and that isness that later thought of itself as a professional, and that isness that now might think of itself as a mother, right? That isness has never changed. It's the same isness. And the funny thing is, of course, as we all know, this is, again, when we're in this room, we tend to be preaching to the choir, but the funny thing is the isness, which has never changed, the isness, which is so core to what we are, that is often not noticed at all. It's kind of taken for granted. It's not even paid attention to. What we pay attention to is what we identify with, and yet what we identify with is always changing. So as this particular journal entry says, when I'm identifying with the body or this changing, maturing person or an opinion or a position or a function or a role or anything else that I could identify myself with, it's like I'm paying attention to the drawing that is drawn on the paper. And I'm not noticing that the drawing is always being drawn and erased and drawn and erased. But what I am is consistently the paper upon which these different drawings are drawn. And I'm always here, even as the drawings are edited and changed. I'm always here. I'm going to go ahead and go to 584, whatever comes after 583, 584A in this case. So I'm going to scroll down and I'm going to click on 584A. And I'm going to start by reading 584 from the Seven Steps to Awakening. Again, these are quotes from Nisargadatta Maharaj. All your problems arise because you have defined and therefore limited yourself. When you do not think yourself to be this or that, all conflict ceases. All your problems arise because you have defined and therefore limited yourself. When you do not think yourself to be this or that, all conflict ceases. Some of you guys know that a couple of weeks ago while in Santa Barbara, I felt guidance to begin a retreat center here in Pueblo for Awakening Together. I should be very clear, for Awakening Together to begin a retreat center here in Pueblo. And one thing I've noticed is the difference with which I have received and the difference with which I am being with this guidance than previous times that I've received, you know, kind of, I'm going to call them these big guidances, because there's guidance all the time. You know, it's like A Course in Miracles workbook lesson 49 says, God's voice speaks to me all through the day. But, you know, often God's voice is speaking to me saying things like, wait, watch, accept, be quiet, be still, let that go. You know, and all of these guidances really add up. But they're not earth-shaking on their own. And there have been a few times in my experience that I've had, you know, larger guidances that are a little more earth-shaking, you know, like when I was guided to leave my job and move to North Carolina, guided to read the New Testament and let it be interpreted through me, guided to join with Laurent when I was asked to ask that picture of Ramana Maharshi, what it wanted to say to me, and I let that come. And then when I was guided to move to Pueblo, those are like the big ones. And this guidance to start a retreat center, I think, I would call that a big one. I would put it in the same category. But what I've noticed then is that there's a difference in the way I have received and the way that I am being with this guidance. Even if we go back to the last one, which was the guidance to move to Pueblo, I remember when the guidance to move to Pueblo came, there was a lot of fear, a lot of fear, a lot of fear. And there was a lot of fear because, well, I guess because I still fully thought of myself as this limited body. And even though I had received this guidance to move to Pueblo, somehow I still thought it was on me to make things happen. I thought it was on me to select the right realtor, and if I selected the wrong realtor, I could screw things up. You know, I thought it was on me to get the house all fixed up just right. And in fact, the funny thing was, I hired this painter to paint the trim. It was a brick house, but I hired this painter to paint the trim, and I think it was like $2,000, which I did not have a lot of money. Any of those of you who remember the story may remember I only had $10,000 left then. I was making no salary at all of any type. And I paid a guy $2,000 of that $10,000 to paint the house, the trim. And, he didn't even scrape it. He just painted over. And so, you know, very quickly, within a month or two, it was already peeling again, like it had never even been painted. And, you know, there's just all kinds of fear about, am I making the right decisions? If I don't make the right decisions, am I screwing this up? Right? A lot of fear going on. And what I noticed this time is that there's a different sense about this project of starting a retreat center. Although there are certainly things that we are doing, and in fact, during the member meeting, I will probably go over some of that. There are certainly things we are doing. At the same time that we are doing things, the sense, I'm trying to figure out how to say this, the sense is that it is the universe that is preparing everything. It is the universe that is moving everything into place. And at the same time, there's not a separation between, it's not like it's me and the universe. I am a part of that, as well as everyone else. I mean, we're all a part of what's being put in place so that this retreat center can happen. So somehow that limited idea that was in place when I got the guidance to move to Pueblo, it's not there now. In fact, there's a huge sense of, I have no real responsibility. I could never make this happen. We just have to wait and see how it unfolds. Even though I'm doing things, you know, and other people are doing things, the whole sense of that doing has changed. And so, again, Nisargadatta is saying, all your problems arise because you have defined and therefore limited yourself. You see how the previous time around I had problems. Oh no, I had a problem selecting the realtor because I felt a burden to find the right realtor. And what if, you know, my fear was, What if I missed the guidance and selected the wrong realtor? You know, now I laugh at that, but that is the way I felt then. And some of you may understand because you may still be thinking that way, right? Now I understand that couldn't have happened, but I didn't understand that then. And so every little aspect of the process of moving to Pueblo was a problem because I perceived myself as limited and I perceived myself as needing to do the right choices, needing to pick up on the right guidance, or somehow I could mess it all up. This time, although, you know, this is probably going to end up being a much bigger project, actually, as far as what needs to be done and the amount of people involved and everything. It's a much, much bigger project than just my move to Pueblo. There's none of those feelings are there. None of those problems are there. There's just this feeling that if we just go step by step doing what we know we are to do now, everything is working together, you know, like the gears on a clock. Everything is working together like clockwork. And as the appropriate time, for lack of a better word, arrives, everything will be in place and the retreat center will happen. And it's just like, it's just working. It's just the sense that it's working. Everything is already in the process of working. So there are no problems. There's no problems because that sense of limitation is not there. That sense that I have to make this happen and I could make wrong decisions or I could miss a prompt. All of that I-ness is not there. Again, Nisargadatta said, all your problems arise because you have defined and therefore limited yourself. When you do not think yourself to be this or that, all conflict ceases. Again, there's just a sense that everything is happening in the direction that it's supposed to happen. So how can you have conflict? Even if, you know, like, as I say, a couple of the team members have an apparent conflict, let's imagine that something comes up where one thinks one and one thinks another and there's this apparent conflict that happens. I don't perceive that apparent conflict as a conflict. I perceive that apparent conflict as a part of what needs to happen, a part of what needs to come up, you know, what needs to be seen, what needs to be released, what needs to happen as this whole retreat center thing is happening. So even the apparent conflict, if it should happen, is not a conflict. It's a part of the everything that is occurring in order for the retreat center to occur. Let's go and see what I wrote in the journal. 584A, which means, again, that I spent a little bit of time contemplating this quote, and I wrote about it in parts. 584A says, why do I believe my thoughts? Why do I give them attention? Because I believe I am the body. I believe I am the body, so I believe I am vulnerable. My thoughts, agreeing that I am vulnerable, come with the promise of salvation. My thoughts say they will protect me, the body. My thoughts defend me, the body. My thoughts point out my enemies in order to keep me, the body, safe from harm and humiliation. All that my thoughts do, in the name of protecting me, keep the idea of me as limited and vulnerable, alive. If that's something you haven't noticed yet, it might be worth watching and noticing. We do seem to have an addiction of listening to our thoughts. And many people have noticed that the thoughts cause suffering. And so there's this appearance that we're just addicted to suffering, which doesn't really make sense. You know, there's something in you that says that's really crazy. It doesn't make sense to be addicted to suffering. Well, this kind of tells us why we're addicted to suffering. Because we've fallen for a story. We've fallen for the story that the thoughts aren't suffering. They are salvation. My thoughts promise to keep my reputation intact. My thoughts promise to, what else do they promise? I don't know. Keep my body safe, make sure I have enough money, make sure I have good health. You know, my thoughts are promise, make sure that I do not lose my lover. You know, just, I'm sure if the longer I sat here and thought about it, the more I would come up with, but I don't think I need to. I think you all get the point. My thoughts are literally promising to save me. So I'm not addicted to suffering because I consciously want suffering. I'm addicted to suffering because I misperceive that the very cause of my suffering, my thoughts, are my salvation. It's kind of like misperceiving the Antichrist for the Christ. I'm confused. And so one way to undo this confusion is to start by noticing, ah, it's true. My thoughts are promising to save me, and that's why I listen. That's the truth. Because whenever we bring anything into awareness, and we see it with clarity, that is the beginning of the end of that. So if I believe that my thoughts are going to save me, but I've never even noticed that I believe that, right? That's like a hidden belief, an unconscious belief, they would call it. If I believe that my thoughts are going to save me, and I start noticing, oh, it's true, I do believe that, the seeing of the fact that I believe that is the beginning of the weakening of the belief. The seeing of the fact that I unconsciously believe my thoughts are going to save me. That's why I listen to them. I think that they're going to protect me. The seeing of that with my awareness is the beginning of the end of that belief. And if that belief is what keeps me listening to my thoughts, then as that belief weakens and dies, I then become free not to listen to my thoughts, which means that's the beginning of the end of suffering. So again, why do I believe my thoughts? Why do I give them attention? Because I believe I am the body. I believe I am the body, so I believe I am vulnerable. My thoughts, agreeing that I am vulnerable, come with the promise of salvation. My thoughts say they will protect me, the body. My thoughts defend me, the body. My thoughts point out my enemies, which could be circumstances. They don't have to be people. They could be circumstances that are my enemies, right? My thoughts point out my enemies. They say, oh, no, that's dangerous. Don't go there. Don't do that, right? My thoughts point out my enemies in order to keep me, the body, safe from harm and humiliation. All that my thoughts do in the name of protecting me, keep the idea of me as limited and vulnerable alive. Again, I'm reading from my contemplation of Nisargadatta's quote. This was the Nisargadatta quote again. All your problems arise because you have defined and therefore limited yourself. When you do not think yourself to be this or that, all conflict ceases. I'm going to scroll down and click on 584B. and read what came next as I continued to contemplate the same quote. How does one lose interest in thoughts? Lose interest in the idea, I am the body. Ask, what value does this belief have for me? Such investigation will clearly point out that there is no advantage to believing I am the body. I can't remember if it was last week or a Sunday before that, but I kind of remember recently in a Seven Steps teaching talking about the fact, one moment, it slipped away. I have to wait for it to come back. It's gone. Let me read this again and see if it comes back. How does one lose interest in thoughts? Lose interest in the idea, I am the body. Ask, oh, I remember. Ask, what value does this belief have for me? Okay, I just talked a moment ago about how when you bring awareness to something, that is the beginning of the end of that, assuming that's a false something, right? You bring awareness to something, that is the beginning to the end of that. In a recent Seven Steps teaching, I also pointed out that that is the purpose of inquiry. Inquiry is the tool that brings attention or awareness to something that needs light to shine on it so that it will be shined away. Inquiry is the tool that brings awareness to something. And awareness is the beginning of the end of that thing. Again, assuming that what we're looking at is something that's false or untrue. Like the belief, I am the body. I don't think we even come close to recognizing how much we digest that belief, I am the body, in a day. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but the thought doesn't show up so clearly as to be a thought that says, I am the body. It doesn't show up that way. You know, maybe if it showed up, you know, 500 times a day, I am the body, I am the body, I am the body, I would say, oh, I hear that, I see that, I get that. But it doesn't show up that way. It shows up as, I have a rash. I'm hungry. I'm fat. Oh, yay, I'm thin right now. I'm tired. I need to go over there. Just all of those types of thoughts. Yeah, it can show up as pains. It shows up as, so there's lots of identification with the body that happens. You know, even the thought, I have to go over there. That's an identification with the body. Yeah, cold, hot. It shows up in so many different ways. And I'm going to assume here, and I could be making an assumption that's wrong. And if so, please forgive me for making an assumption about you that isn't true. I'm going to assume here that the vast majority of the time, if not on most days, 100% of the time, we blindly believe the I am the body thought without even noticing that we're believing the I am the body thought. And so, of course, it's just reinforced and reinforced and reinforced and reinforced. That's the purpose of inquiry. Inquiry is to bring my attention or my awareness to the believing, looking at the believing. And anything I bring my awareness to, well, that's the beginning of the end of that, assuming that is a false belief. Bringing my awareness to awareness won't end it because it's true. It will only magnify it. But bringing my awareness to a false belief is the beginning of the end of that. So a question like, what value does this belief have for me? What value does the belief, I am the body, have for me? Now, if I just ask that once and forget about the question, it might not do much. But if I start contemplating that question as a practice throughout the day for several days, what's going to happen as I contemplate that question is I'm going to bring more and more and more awareness to every time I'm believing the idea I am the body. I'll start noticing in sort of a miraculous way, you know, when I say I need to go over to Sue's house, something will jump out at me. Like, I've said something like that millions of times in this lifetime. But now, because I've been contemplating the question, what value does the belief I am the body have for me? Now suddenly my awareness is showing up. And I'm saying, ah, look at that. When I say I am going to go over to Sue's house, I'm identifying with this body. Look at that. When I say I have a toothache, I'm identifying with this body. When I say I am tired, I'm identifying with this body. And then if I keep asking, what value is there in that for me? What value, what real value, can I find a value in the idea that I have to go over to Sue's today? Is there something that I get out of that belief? No, not anything that I can see. It doesn't sound like anything I need. The going over to Sue's will still happen. But I don't need to be identified with the body. I can back up and be the watcher of the going over to Sue's, right? Is there a value that I get, right? An honest value that I get? Now, some people might answer, well, you get the value of believing you're a separate self. But if that's the answer that comes up, well, then I'm going to say, well, what value do I get out of that? Is there value in believing I'm a separate self? If I just keep questioning with clarity, I'm going to see there is no value. There is no real value to believing I'm a body. I don't get anything. I don't get anything. I just except stuck with a false belief. And if I keep questioning and keep looking, the belief is just going to begin to weaken and fade. And then I'm going to start having this different sense. This different sense that is not the I am the body belief. I don't know what you would name that sense. Maybe it's best not to name that sense. But a different sense. So again, Nisargadatta said, all your problems arise because you have defined and therefore limited yourself. When you do not think yourself to be this or that, all conflict ceases. And 584b says, how does one lose interest in thoughts? Lose interest in the idea, I am the body. Ask, what value does this belief have for me? Such investigation will clearly point out that there is no advantage to believing I am the body. And I'm going to scroll down and click on 585A. What am I smelling?
Pancakes.
It smells good.
I'd give you some, but I ate them all.
That's okay. I can't eat pancakes and talk at the same time anyway.
Okay.
I knew it had a breakfast smell, though. I could sense breakfast, and so...
Yeah.
But I didn't identify it as pancakes. All right. So I am going to read 585 from The Seven Steps to Awakening. There is no such thing as a person. There is no such thing as a person. That's the quote. And again, even though it's a very short quote, I contemplated it enough to have more than one writing about it. So I will start with 585A. If there is no advantage to the belief I am the body, and the idea is not true, why does mind cling to this idea with such tenacity? You know, I'm reminded right now when Jesus went into the Garden of Gethsemane. If you know the story is actually told slightly differently in the different Gospels that tell the story, but the book of Mark tells the story as if Jesus went into the Garden of Gethsemane, of course was fearful at first, and then he surrendered to Abba, right? He surrendered to Abba, and then he came out. And as he came out of the garden, the fear began to come over him again. And he went back into the garden, surrendered again, came out, and then had to go back in a third time. This is the way Mark tells the story. And one of the comments that Jesus is making while he's going through this process is that the spirit is willing, but the body is weak. Right? The spirit is willing, but the body is weak. Now, the body, it doesn't have a mind of its own. So the body itself can't be weak. It's just that what he was really referring to was this idea, I am the body, is tenacious, right? That belief, I am the body, is tenacious. And that's what caused him to need to go into the garden three times before he was completely surrendered and completely willing for what was about to play out. Again, 585A says, if there is no advantage to the belief I am the body and the idea is not true, why does mind cling to this idea with such tenacity? The mind believes it is a self. The appearance of a body makes this seem more true. Attachment to the body as what I am, protects the mind's thoughts from disinterest. In short, the belief I am the body fully supports the mind's illusion I am a self. In a way, we've just gone full circle. We started this half hour saying that the reason we listen to our thoughts is because we believe they're going to protect us. Right? And so we listen to them. That's why. And this says that the mind believes it is a self, and the mind projects or makes the body and the attachment to the body, because if we believe we're a body, we're going to believe we need protection, and we're going to keep listening to the mind. You know, like it's a setup. And again, the exercise to this setup, the exercise to bring an end to this setup, would be the same as the exercise we saw at the beginning of the hour. It would be noticing that the reason I listen to my thoughts is because I believe they're going to protect me. Seeing that that's true. And then maybe following it up with the inquiry, what value do I get out of believing I'm a body? Bringing even more awareness to that. We just want to shine the light. Shine the light of awareness. These ideas thrive because the majority of the time, and that feels like an understatement, the majority of the time that these thoughts are happening, we're believing them without any awareness at all. They thrive in the darkness of our non-awareness. They thrive in the darkness of our not looking, just believing. And so we want to bring looking. In the light of our looking, they cannot thrive. They will weaken and die. So we notice, look, I'm listening to my thoughts because I think I'm a body, and these thoughts are telling me how they're going to keep me safe, save me from humiliation, save me from running out of money, save me from poor health. And then ask the next question. What advantage is there? What value is there to believing I'm the body? Do I really need this? And start breaking that connection, that attachment that is set up between mind and body. Because without the connection, the attachment between mind and body, we won't listen to the mind much longer, and the mind itself will begin to die. The mind, meaning the wrong mind, for those of you who study A Course in Miracles. So by zeroing in on the attachment between the mind and the body, I'm actually beginning the process of letting the wrong mind die. Because the wrong mind survives on that attachment. We would not listen to the mind if we did not believe we were a body. But because we believe we are a body, we listen to the mind because the mind is promising to save us. David asks, why must the wrong mind die? Why is peace more valuable than suffering? Well, there's someone in the room behind me kind of giggling. She would do anything for peace. But I understand, and I think maybe where your question comes from, I think that the mind likes to play tricks. And I think that if the mind sees peace as a goal, it starts all kinds of chatter about that goal, and that chatter actually results in additional suffering. So it's probably most helpful not to see peace as a goal that I must work toward. That is also going to just support the mind. It's most helpful to recognize that peace is just our natural state and that it is here now. And that the state is fully realized when the suffering dies down. By the way, when we talk about the wrong mind dying, that can have more than one meaning if you really contemplate all of the teachings by all of the masters. If you contemplate those teachings deeply, they will talk about the mind dying, when what they are really saying, if you look at their every line of what they're saying, is that there is no more attachment to the mind. They often will say that the mind is still chattering, but there's no one listening. And yet they still call that the ego death. So these words can have meanings that sometimes are not easily seen if we haven't contemplated fully. One thing about words is that words can only talk about one thing at a time. In fact, there's an exercise in the Understanding Purification course, which some of the MPP participants are going through right now. And that exercise is about looking for a moment, looking without thinking, and seeing if there's intellectual understanding, not intellectual, see if there is true understanding without any thinking, without any words, without any labeling. And those who have done the practice have seen that there is an intelligence, an intuitive intelligence that knows without any thinking at all. And what they also noticed is once the thinking came back in, they noticed the intuitive intelligence was able to take everything in at once and understand it fully. But once the thinking came in, it had to break it up into parts. It had to say, that is a tree, that is a fence, that is grass. And the intuitive intelligence was able to take it in all at once. It didn't need to break it apart. So what happens when teaching happens with words, and when listening to teaching happens and it's taking in the words, the teaching is always in parts because of the words. There's a wholeness, however, that is being pointed to. And it's really the wholeness we want to be open to understand. So let me go back to 585A. If there is no advantage to the belief I am the body and the idea is not true, why does mind cling to this idea with such tenacity? The mind believes it is a self. The appearance of a body makes this seem more true. Attachment to the body as what I am protects the mind's thoughts from disinterest. In short, the belief I am the body fully supports the mind's illusions of a self. So if I believe I am the body, I am going to remain engaged with the mind, continue to believe the mind, and the suffering continues. The suffering continues. Without that attachment, there is no suffering. But again, as I pointed out, the mind can play a trick if we say peace is a goal. We need to realize that peace really is our natural state. Peace is here now. It is simply covered up by the attachment to mind. We don't have to achieve peace. We only need to notice that we aren't interested in the mind. And that is a natural non-interest, by the way, if you look. There's nothing to struggle about. We are naturally not interested in the mind, but we need to look to see that. We need to look to realize the wisdom, the intelligence of our true self, and to see we have no interest in the mind. Without the looking, we just stay caught up in it. That takes us to 585B. 585B again is still working with this same quote. There is no such thing as a person. And it says, this belief, I am a person, ties the beliefs, I am a body and the mind is a self, together in an identity attachment alliance. Look at this. It's like a three-legged stool. David and I talked once in Santa Barbara about how with a three-legged stool, something can stand. And if you cut off one of those legs, it has to fall. Well, here we have a three-legged stool that's letting this false belief about who we are stand. One of the legs is the belief, I am a person. One of the legs is the belief, I am the body. And one of the legs is the belief, this mind is myself. If one of those beliefs become weakened and dies, the entire stool topples all over. I'm going to move on to 585C. The identity attachment alliance, supported by the belief I am a person, is not anything more than one untrue idea tied together with another untrue idea. Therefore, it's false thought resulting in nothing but illusion. Adyashanti talks about spiritual aspiration. And at least in the way that I understand him, he says that the best or the most valuable or the most worthwhile spiritual aspiration of all is to want to know truth. Whatever it is, just to want to know truth because it is truth. Right? Well, what 585C is saying is by believing I am a person and by believing I am a body and by believing the mind is what I am, I'm caught in an illusion. I don't know truth. And if I'm happy with that, I just want a happier mind, for example, or a better looking body, or a more loving person, I might stay in that triad relationship for a while. But the truth of what I am is covered up. What if I just want to know truth? What if I have no interest in falsehood anymore? I want to know the truth of what I am. Adyashanti says that's the most powerful spiritual aspiration. And I can see why. Because I'm not going to question as vigilantly if I'm happy with this person, happy with this body, happy with this mind. And all I really seek was happiness. There'll be a place where I might become stalled. But if I want truth, and there's something in me, some intuition in me that keeps saying, this is not true, this can't be true, this isn't constant, this is not the truth of what you are, I'm going to keep seeking even beyond that point of happiness. When I say keep seeking, I mean keep inquiring, keep bringing awareness to false beliefs, not setting on my laurels. And as I continue to bring awareness to false beliefs, those beliefs weaken and die. And then the truth can shine of its own accord because there's nothing blocking it. This is what's called self-realization. So the identity attachment alliance, supported by the belief I am a person, is not anything more than one untrue idea tied together with another untrue idea. Therefore, it is false thought resulting in nothing but illusion. So one inquiry I might want to bring in well, the way it's coming to me is, do I want to know the truth about myself? Or you could ask, am I happy believing an illusion? Am I happy being deceived? Am I, you know, it's reminding me of the movie The Matrix, right? There was that one character in the movie who wanted to be deceived again, remember? He was eating his steak and he said he wanted to believe again that his steak was real. He wanted to be deceived. But the question is that what I want? Do I want to be deceived or do I want to know truth? And you know what? There may still be some like that character in Matrix that are like, I'm okay being deceived. I'm okay with that. And if so, that is cool. But then there are going to be others that are going to say, no, I want to know truth. There's something in me. I can't explain it. There's something in me that's calling for truth. You know, when the spiritual path really started for me, it was way back, I don't know when, in early 1980s. And that's when I said a prayer. And the prayer was, please show me the truth. I don't care what it is. That prayer started something. But notice it was a prayer for truth. Please show me the truth. I don't care what it is. You see, I didn't need the truth to meet any certain ideas that I wanted to hold on to. And anybody who really wants that, who doesn't want to be deceived, who wants to be completely clear seen, we're going to question every idea. Even if we don't appear to be suffering now like we did at an earlier time because enough false beliefs have fallen away, we're still going to question. We're not going to stop. We're not going to stop until we know truth beyond all doubt. No more hiddenness at all.